Hello and welcome to today's program on the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is Applying the Wisdom of Mr. Rogers to the Workplace with Donna and Ian Mitroff. So I'm now just going to turn it over to them. They will introduce themselves and then we have a special guest who will be arriving shortly.
It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood. Neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. So let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor?
You could all say speed delivery. We'll start that way. Here we go. One, two, three.
Speed delivery.
There you go.
I would just say, is there anyone here who doesn't remember Mr. McGinn?
I didn't think so.
They're just coming.
I need to be on the mic.
Here's a delivery for everybody.
Can I take it out?
That's the wisdom from the neighborhood. There we go. And we're getting on the microphone. They tell us we have to be on the microphone, so here we go.
Welcome, everybody. How many of you either watched Mr. Rogers when you were children or watched with your children? Let me just see a show of hands. There you are, just about everybody in the room. And if you're familiar with the show, you know that Mr. McFeely, a.k.a. David Newell, was on every single show from the first year that the show went on the air, which was in 1968. So that's 45 years.
45 years this year.
45 years of being Mr. McFeely. Now, David has been kind enough to join us today, and I need for you to advance. And there he is. And David has become an icon in his own right. The next slide, please. He is the subject of a documentary film called Speedy Delivery. And I'm sure you can find it at Amazon. Or
Amazon and online.
And online. So David himself is an icon. So we've asked David to just take a few minutes to tell you about, you know, a little bit about how he got to know Fred and how he worked with him for all of those years, since it's so special to have him here with us.
Okay, well, let me move this down so they don't get that in the picture. I'll put it right here, and that way you can all see. So my name is David Newell, and I'll just take a few moments to tell you my role in all of this. I started in 1967 with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I thought I had a job for 1 year, and here I am 45 years later. We came on the air in February 19th, 1968. We started the tape, but we came on the air in 1968. And what a 45 years it's been. I'd do it all over again. To work with Fred Rogers, I feel like I have a doctorate degree in child development. I don't, but I feel I've learned so much, and it was so much fun coming to work every day. I look forward to it. And I met my wife at the during the taping of the program. We have three children and now three grandchildren, and it's really been a way of life for me. And Donna has been one of our biggest supporters. The Mitroffs have. She is responsible for one of the first publications that we ever had called Mr. Rogers' Plan and Playbook, which is chock full of material for daycare centers and preschools and parents. And thank you, Donna, for that. And now they've come up with, those children have grown up, and there is now a book for them. So that's why we're here today. And they've been diligently working at this book. And I just my pleasure to turn it over to you guys. But don't discard your sayings. And a little later, I have a picture similar to the one you saw. If you want an autograph for anybody, be glad to do it. I'll be here. I'm going to sit in the back and take all this in myself. So one more time, I'm going to count to three, and you can all humor me one more time. One, two, three, and
speedy delivery.
It's yours, but troughs, there you go. I'll just get here. I want to take the cup. Or you keep it for you.
I'm in here.
Okay.
Now, David will be staying, and he will be back at the end of the show, and he does have a big handful of photographs, and he'll be happy to autograph those photographs for you, for your grandchildren, or whomever you want to pass them on to. So we, my husband and I, want to welcome you to the first, this is our first presentation of the Fables and the Art of Leadership. The book came out in December. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. And they, Palgrave Macmillan, are marketing it as a textbook, a supplementary text to be used in business and leadership classes. We know that it has interest to all of you who watched the show, who grew up with Mr. Rogers, and that's why we wanted to come here to the Commonwealth today and share this with you. So our plan for the day is to let you know who we are and how we came to be involved with this project, to review a bit of the Fred Rogers story, and to share with you how the book came to be and how it's structured, how we managed to make use of the concepts from Fred Rogers' work. And then we will ultimately discuss the lessons for the workplace from Mr. Rogers' philosophy and sayings and all of his publications.
Well, that's us in 1975, a little bit younger. In 1967, when I finished my PhD in Berkeley, I went to the University of Pittsburgh. It was my first academic job, where I taught in the business school at the University of Pittsburgh till 1980. Till I had a chair at USC, where we were for 26 years, retired from USC. And we've been back in the Bay Area since 2006. And I'm now an adjunct at UC Berkeley, teaching there. But we'll say a little bit more later on. Donna?
While we were in Pittsburgh, I went back to graduate school and got a degree in education with a concentration in child development. In 1977, I joined the staff of WQED as their director of educational services. The first day that I was on the job, I got on the elevator, and the person who got on next to me was Fred Rogers. I had a young child at home, and I was absolutely verklempt because I was sharing an elevator with Mr. Rogers. And by the time we got to the third floor, I told him my life story, and he said, "Why don't you come by and we'll talk sometime about something that we might do together?" And little did I know that, you know, Fred had that way of roping you in. So we did get together and began conversations, and because I came out of this strong educational background, we started talking about not only what you do when you watch the show with kids, but what could you do after you watched the show to enhance the lessons that he had built into the programs? And those conversations led to the Mr. Rogers Plan and Playbook. That's it. And it started out as a set of mimeographed sheets that we mailed out to people. You know, we didn't have email. We didn't have all of the ways of getting materials. We mailed them to teachers, daycare providers, parents, preschool teachers, and the idea really caught on, and eventually PBS decided that through their Ready to Learn project, they could distribute these materials, and it then grew into the big Plan and Playbook that is still in use in many Ready to Learn classes across the country where Mr. Rogers is still shown on PBS stations. I continued to work with the Fred Rogers Company after we left Pittsburgh and moved to Southern California. I continued to work with them. They became my lifelong friends and became one of those many people interested in keeping the world aware of the wisdom of Fred Rogers. Most of you probably know that Fred was not a TV personality. Fred Rogers was a musician. He was a puppeteer. He was a lyricist. He was a poet. And he had advanced degrees in child development, and he was also an ordained Presbyterian minister. His mission was to reach children through the media. And this was in the 60s, when media was new, when Fred finished college in Florida and television was new. He went home to his parents and said, I'm not going to go to the ministry now. I'm going to go to work in this business called television, because it's got to be better than what I see. If you remember in the 50s and 60s, children's television was people throwing pies in each other's faces. And he said, there has to be something better than that. And so he began to develop this idea for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Over the years, the show has won countless awards. It has at least five Emmys, two Peabodys. He's received the Congressional Medal of Honor. He has been honored in the Television Academy's Hall of Fame. And he has over 40 honorary degrees from universities all over the country, all over the world, in fact. And eventually, he was given the Lifetime Achievement Award by the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Now, the show launched in 1968. It actually launched on February the 19th. So that is literally, we are here almost at the anniversary of the launch of the show. And it still today is the longest running show on any network. It's been continuously on the air for, I believe, 35 years. It is no longer continuously on the air, but it is still shown in many PBS stations, and you can still get the shows online. It was so different from what was being done at the time, and it still stands out as something unique, because what Fred did was to share real life events with children, and he was a real human being who spoke directly to each individual in the audience. He looked right into the eyes of the person in the audience. He never found him, never thought of the huge numbers that were out there. What he thought about is that one child who was watching the show. He also tackled very difficult subjects. He was one of the first to do a show about divorce and how do children feel about that. When Robert Kennedy was assassinated, he did a show about assassination. He took on big topics, and he addressed those topics in ways that young people could understand. He spoke directly to the inner life of children. Now, the inner life of children is still the inner life of grown-ups, and that's one of the reasons that we're here today talking to you. I just want to remind you of a few of the characters from the show. Can anybody tell me who the man with the crown is?
King Friday.
King Friday, that's right. King Friday and his wife, Queen Sarah Saturday, and the lady with the red jacket on. Anybody know her? That's Lady Elaine Fairchild, the one who's talking to the little puppet. That's Lady Aberlin. The show was a mixture of puppets and costumed characters, and in every single show, Fred took kids from the real world into this magical neighborhood of make-believe. These are just a few of the characters. There are many more, and we're going to talk about a few of them. Fred invented all of the characters himself, and he did a lot of the puppeteering himself. So his talents are are very wide and very broad. Next one. Now, over the years that I continue to be involved with the with my friends from the Fred Rogers Company, and continued to mine the incredible things that Fred wrote, talked about, and played out on his shows, I was getting, you know, more and more overwhelmed by how incredibly wise he was. Fred died in 2003, and later in that same year, as a member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, I was asked to participate in the creation of a very special program that was to be a tribute to Fred Rogers. So this was the television industry with all of with all of its negativism, and they just came together on a very special night and celebrated Fred and his consistency of good purpose and good work for kids. During the time that we were preparing the tribute to Fred Rogers, I was reading a lot of the materials, coming home and telling my husband, who, as you heard, has been a teacher of management, org behavior, and leadership for almost 50 years now. I was coming home and telling him, listen to this. Fred said this. Fred talked about this. Fred did that. And he said, I think that there's more wisdom in what you're telling me than what I'm teaching to students in management schools. And then on that very evening when we're doing the tribute, a very high-level executive from Disney, Ann Sweeney, who is one of those loyal followers of Fred Rogers, stood up there on the stage and said, Fred not only influenced me when I was a kid, he continues to influence me as an adult. From Fred, I learned the importance of listening with one's entire being, to be fully and completely in the moment with whomever I was engaged. I learned how to listen to the inner person. This is the essence of being a true leader. When we were both at this event, and when we realized that someone at the level of Ann Sweeney could acknowledge that she learned from Fred as a child, but she still continues to refer to his lessons, we thought, there's something here. There's something we need to talk about. And that led us to three important ideas.
Well, the more that Donna came home and told me about what she was reading, rereading of Fred's material, these three realizations occurred to both of us. The first one is that the lessons that Fred were teaching were more profound than what you find in traditional management and textbooks. They're dry. They don't reach the inner soul. They really don't speak to our spirit. The second thing is when you talk to kids, you don't give them didactic lessons. He taught and he reached people through stories and fables, and those are the essence of really what make us human. Only humans concoct stories and fables. Three, those who watch Fred as children are now today's middle and upper managers and executives. In fact, if we had to summarize the whole book that we've written, is he helped you when you were a child, he can help you now that you're an adult. Go on to the next one here. Just the picture of some of the traditional books, particularly the academic books, are totally dry. Now, the popular books do use stories, but they concoct stories. They don't go back to the stories that you heard as a kid, because the whole point of Fred, those stories still resonate in us. All the stories you heard as a kid, they're still there in our memory bank, and that was the basis of our book, because when we looked at seven of the fables in particular. We'll talk about those in a second. They really can be interpreted, and without any stretch of the imagination, as little mini business cases. I have to go back to one thing that my wife said earlier. It would be nice if Fred won the Congressional Medal of Honor. He wasn't a soldier. It was the Presidential Medal of Freedom, I believe. But anyway, because there are all these kind of urban legends about Fred, that he was a SEAL and all the rest of that. That's nonsense. Fred didn't need to be that. He was an authentic human being. what you saw on television was what you got if you met him in person. And I was fortunate enough to meet him a few times, and he was just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, stay with us. So, you know, we talked to you a little about the power of stories and fables, but the back one. But the idea that all of those kids in that picture are grown up, and some of you are here in the room today. You watched him when you were at that very important time period, and now you're in these management positions, and you're struggling with issues that that you may not have anticipated. It's actually a very huge audience. There's the nostalgic audience, those who watched with their kids, and there's also the audience that grew up with Mr. Rogers. At the peak of the broadcast of the show, there were over 5 million kids a day, 5 days a week, watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So there are a lot of people who have these important stories embedded in their head. Now we're going to shift over and talk to you about this book, how we've shaped it and how we put it together.
Okay, let me say a little bit about the power of fables, because it really is the heart of the book. Stories and fables are how one engages and holds the attentions of young children. But they're also one of the main ways in which one gains the attention of adults. But they're even more basic than this. Humans are the only creatures of which we know that invent and listen to fables and stories. They are the very essence of what makes us human. Through the use of fanciful characters, animals, and magic, fables take us out of everyday reality, transport us to places and situations that are sharper and larger than life, and thereby teach us profound moral lessons. Fables impact us as few other forms of communication do, because they hit squarely in our guts and in our souls. Because they apply to every aspect of life, every one of the fables that Fred wrote, even though he's writing for kids, have fundamental lessons for leadership that we ought to practice as adults.
So as we went through this process of rediscovering Fred's work, Ian went through the materials, and he was able to extract 7 principles. That's the next slide, Dana.
Okay, I'm going to say a brief word about this, because what we did is there was a marvelous quote that Fred had that really was the essence of every one of them. But here are the 7 C's. Since I was trained, a big part of my education was in philosophy. When I was getting my PhD in engineering, I took a 3.5-year minor in philosophy and social science, which forever changed me. And it's, even though I loved engineering, I didn't want to be an engineer my whole life. So the man who taught me philosophy was in a business school of all places. He was a philosopher, so I went into business school. But through philosophy, it's really high-level pattern making. So as I read through all the material Donna had, it said, oh my God, I realized we could organize the material in terms of 7 C's. And I'm going to go through each of them, Dean, if you'll go to the next slide. So the first C is 7, and here's the quote from Fred. A person can grow to his or her fullest capacity only in mutually caring relationships with others. And we have an accompanying fable that we'll get into a little bit later that illustrates the principle. Next one, please. Setting rules is one of the primary ways in which we show our love. That's really important. One of the myths about Fred is that he was totally permissive. Not so. Fred realized that appropriate rules, good rules, was one of the best gifts we gave children. That's how we civilized ourselves and others. So he wasn't permissive. Doesn't mean the rules were harsh and they had to be delivered in a heart. They had to be delivered with love, but we need rules. Next one, please. Play is the expression of our creativity. Creativity, and creativity, I believe, is at the very root of our ability to learn, to cope, to become whatever we may be. And we're going to talk about one of the fables in relation to that. It's one of our favorites. And the moral of the fable, which we'll talk about, to be creative, you have to be childlike again without being childish. Next one, please. communication. In times of stress, the best thing we can do for each other is listen with our ears and our hearts to be assured that our questions are just as important as our answers. One of the things that Fred said, as many others, we listen with more than our ears and we speak with more than our tongues and our mouths. We speak with our souls. Next one, please. Consciousness. Take good care of that part of you where your best dreams come from, that invisible part of you that allows you to look upon yourself and your neighbor with delight. That was Fred's spirituality in life and action. Next one, courage. One of the greatest paradoxes about omnipotence is that we need to feel it early in life, as a baby, as a child, and lose it early in life in order to achieve a healthy, realistic, yet exciting sense of potency later on. Finally, the last one, all of us at some time or another need help. And I might amend that to say pretty much all of the time. Whether we're giving or receiving help, each one of us is something valuable to bring to this world. That's one of the things that connects us as neighbors. In our own way, each one of us is a giver and a receiver. Next one, please. Okay, here are the seven C's, and just listed there on the left are the fables that illustrate everyone. And let me read this off for the hearing audience. So the first one is Planet Purple. Planet Purple is one of the great fables that, Fred invented and told. And that illustrates the seven C of community. The fable Good Friends illustrates connect. No Bare Hands in This Land illustrates concern. The Bass Violin Festival is the epitome of creativity. The Reluctant Ring Bearer illustrates communication, and once upon each lovely day is apropos for consciousness. And finally, Daniel Tiger and the Snowstorm illustrates courage. Next one, please.
So each of the concepts was paired to a statement from Fred, and each of the concepts or principles is also paired with one of the fables from the neighborhood of make-believe. In order to find the appropriate fables, we work very closely with people from the neighborhood, people who had worked with Fred for many years. And in fact, the book is produced in association with the Fred Rogers Company. It's one of the reasons that David is here today. And we still work very closely. I work very closely with them on other projects as well. What we're going to do now, just to give you a taste of how we can take a fable from the neighborhood of make-believe and use it as a mini business case, is share two examples with you. The first one we're going to share is Planet Purple. So bear with me and my voice that is getting a little bit shaky, but I'm going to read this very short story called The Story of Planet Purple. And while I'm reading it, think about it in terms of the lessons that you might hear that have to do with your life as an adult. On a space mission, Lady Elaine Fairchild discovers a planet where everything looks the same. It is a place where everything is purple. Everyone has the same purple home. The sky is purple, the cars, the chairs, the streets are purple, and there are the same purple trees everywhere. In addition, all of the boys are named Paul, and all of the girls are named Pauline, and every single panda is called Purple Panda. Everyone on Planet Purple eats purple pumpernickel bread and talks in the same monotonous voice, and everybody dreams the same dreams and has the same hopes. When Lady Elaine Fairchild's spaceship, which is made out of bright green leaves, lands on Planet Purple, she steps out in her white astronaut suit, and the Planet Purple people run and hide because they have never seen anything like her before. But one Paul and one Pauline and one purple panda did not run and hide. They stayed around to look at this curious creature. Lady Elaine's favorite color just happens to be purple. As a result, she turns her spaceship around and flies back to tell everyone in the neighborhood of make-believe about the intriguing planet that she has discovered. Lady Elaine doesn't know that Paul, Pauline, and Purple Panda watch where she is going and decide to follow her. Now, the purple way to travel is just by thinking, and thinking alone. On Planet Purple, all you have to do is think that you're someplace, and instantly you'll be there. So Paul, Pauline, and Purple Panda think about Lady Elaine and where she is, and immediately they arrive in the neighborhood of make-believe. They can hardly believe what they see and hear. Everything and everybody is different. Purple Panda is so excited that he sits down on the first rocking chair he sees, and he rocks and he rocks and he rocks, and then he remembers one of Planet Purple's laws. Anyone who rocks in a rocking chair may not live on Planet Purple. But now it's too late. He can never go back. But he doesn't even feel sad. In fact, he secretly wonders if the reason he forgot the rule and sat down in the rocking chair and rocked was so he would have to stay in this exciting neighborhood. Paul and Pauline decide that they do want to go back, but first they want to explore this new place. They go everywhere. They look, they listen, they sniff, and they touch. In their minds, they feel the different colors and smell the different smells and feel the different feelings. One day, Paul falls down and hurts himself. He feels something wet trickling down his cheek. When Albert the rabbit asks him why he is crying, he has to ask what crying means. No one ever cries on Planet Purple. When Albert hears that Paul has never cried before, he says, "Well then, you have just started to live." After a while, Paul and Pauline decide to return to Planet Purple. As soon as they think about being there, they're back home. They tell the other Pauls and Paulines about the place where Lady Elaine lives and how everything is so different and nobody is exactly the same as anyone else. They even tell about Purple Panda rocking in the rocking chair, and everyone knows he's broken the law and can never come back. Paul and Pauline help the Planet Purple people imagine the different colors, sounds, the smells, the feelings they had learned about until all the people on Planet Purple want to be different. It takes a long time to change their planet. Some people don't like these things, and other people don't like other things. But everybody says that being different is better than being all the same all the time. They even changed the law about rocking chairs so Purple Panda can come back anytime he wants to. And then to show their appreciation to Lady Elaine for helping them become different, the citizens of Planet Purple hold a celebration to announce that the name of Planet Purple will now be Planet Purple Fairchild. Both Lady Elaine and Purple Panda come to the celebration.
And next slide, please. We boil down some of the primary lessons of the fable. And here are the main, at least five of the main lessons. Planet Purple organizations, unfortunately, are still the dominant ones today, and they're repressive. Even though, you know, we talk about flat organizations and all the other ways that organizations change, that is still, unfortunately, the predominant model. Second lesson is that in Planet Purple organizations, which is still dominant today, one must, in effect, disconnect one's body and one's feelings from one's thoughts. Three, changing the culture of an organization, we all know, is certainly not easy. It's not impossible, but it's a long haul. Four, the alternative Planet Purple organization is what we in the book call Planet Prism organizations, which are really organizations made up of diverse people. They all look and speak the same. They are different, which means we have to learn to get along and manage our differences, which is no small problem. Five, today's organizations require integration and connectedness between our brains, our bodies, our feelings, and our souls and spirits. I might add that, about 11 years ago, 12 years ago, I wrote one of the first books on spirituality at work, spirituality in the workplace, a spiritual audit of corporate America. And I went out and I was able to interview scores of people, and we did a national survey. Before I did the book and talking with my colleagues, they were all skeptical whether I would be able to get people in organizations talk about something as mushy and gushy as spirituality. And I talked to people in a number of organizations, hard-headed, and they had been waiting for the opportunity to talk about something that they'd never been allowed to give voice to before. So we do ourselves a disservice when we don't talk about the things that really do move people in organizations. And the primary lesson here is that we need integration. It's when I talk to people when I did my interviews about spirituality and organization, they said, we resent having to come to work and leave a vital part of ourselves at home. We want to become connected. Next slide, please. Okay, the Base Violin Festival. This is truly one of our favorite of all the fables.
As you listen to this story, think of King Friday as the CEO, and think about the people around him, the subjects, as the employees of his organization. The Base Violin Festival. One day in the neighborhood of Make Believe, King Friday receives a message from the mayor of Southwood, an adjoining locality, saying that she would like to arrange a festival that involves all four of the surrounding neighborhoods. King Friday likes the idea and immediately proclaims that it will be a bass violin festival. Chuck Aber, one of his subjects, points out that he, the king, is the only one who actually plays the bass violin. Undaunted by this reminder, King Friday says, "Ah, so I am. Well, it looks like I'll have a very large audience." The subjects of the neighborhood of Make-Believe are pleased at the prospect of a joint neighborhood festival, but quite taken aback at the news that it will be just a bass violin festival and that they must all participate. Lady Aberlin is particularly disconcerted when King Friday presents her with a bass violin and describes it as a brand new fine instrument that was made by an excellent instrument maker. She acknowledges that it may be a very special bass violin. However, she says to him, she absolutely cannot play the bass violin. She tells him that just because a person has a fine instrument doesn't mean that the person can play it well. King Friday shrugs his shoulders and tells her to keep on practicing. Over the next few days, the various characters meet to share their frustration about being required to perform a skill that they do not have. During one of their discussions, Lady Elaine Fairchild arrives and tells them that she has a solution to the problem. She produces her accordion, the instrument that she can play very well, which is covered by a false front to make it look like a bass violin. She tells the others that she will play her bass violin for them, and they watch and listen in amazement until Lady Aberlin points out that she's actually playing her accordion. Lady Elaine acknowledges that it is indeed her accordion, but since it looks like a bass violin, it could work for the Bass Violin Festival. Lady Elaine's clever solution gives the others an important idea. They could all think of ways to make what they do well look like a bass violin, so they can contribute to the festival. Lady Aberlin knows how to dance, so she decides to dance with the bass violin. Miss Polificate puts on a costume to make her look like a bass violin, and she literally plays at being a bass violin. Keith and James Michael Jones make bass violin puppets and plan to perform a bass violin conversation. Another neighbor plans to be a very special flower to decorate the performance. She will be a bass violet. Old Goat decides to recite a poem about the bass violin. In the midst of their excitement about their plans, they realize that King Friday needs to be told what they are doing, and they become a little worried that he may not like the news. Lady Aberlin confides her concern to Daniel Tiger. Daniel helps her reach the conclusion that the best thing to do is simply tell the king the truth, that not everybody can play the bass violin, so they're going to do other things with it, things that they can do well. With the support and encouragement of her friends, excuse me a minute, she goes and confides to King Friday and tells him the truth. He listens to the plans they've made, and he concludes that, you know what? These are pretty clever ideas, and that this festival could turn out to be something very special. And indeed it is, a very special bass violin festival with everyone contributing his or her own special talent.
Next slide, please. Before I talk about the lessons, I might just say a word about the structure of the book. What we do, the book has three parts. The first part we just mainly give the fables with very little commentary, so that the reader, he or she, as she is reading the fables, can say what the fable means to that person. And we didn't want to interfere. The second part we give kind of like a standard business interpretation. And the third part of the book, which is more textbooky, we apply some different kind of frameworks to it. But this is like the in the second part of the book, that it really is a business case if you think about it, that technology alone is never a substitute for skill. If you give people the latest technology, more often than not, it scares them, particularly if they don't know how to use it. I remember on a flight I took across the country talking to one of the stewards on Southwest Air, one of the flight attendants, and I was asking about how they hire, and the woman said, Southwest Air hires for attitude and trains for skill. They start with a big pool of people and they narrow it down, and the main thing is how you're going to interact with people. The skill they can train. The attitude, yeah, they can bring it out of you if it's there, but it's got to be there. Second point there, technology, as I said, often only increases our fears and anxieties and makes us painfully aware of our shortcomings. I'm sure nobody in this room feels that interacting with computers and all the things we do today. Just raise them up. Number three, often when we're afraid, we project our fears onto others. Instead of owning our fears, we blame others. See, we don't know in the fable that King Friday may have set up his subjects to see if they would become creative rather than just falling in the trap, I got to learn this technology. Four, creativity forces us to confront our deepest fears. Will we look foolish and be laughed at if we expose our ideas and feelings to the world? I mean, come on, being in the academic world, I know the self-censoring that goes on that is so painful. When I wrote my book on spirituality, the first question I was invariably asked when I went out to academic groups and I spoke about, weren't you afraid to write such a book? And I played along, what do you mean? Well, it's so far out of the mainstream. And that's what we do. We saw, here I was a tenured professor with a chair. Five, to be creative, we have to be a child again. We have to be childlike without being childish. And that is the hardest thing to bring forth in an organization, particularly for the leaders, to set up a culture that will make that appear. One thing I might note is that I'm a member of a new center in Berkeley for healthy organizations, of which the director is here. And I would say our book is as much about healthy organizations as it is about the seven C's, because if Fred stood for anything, it was for individual health, healthy people, healthy organizations.
And one other thing that we like to point out about this story has to do with reframing the problem. When the subjects were given an assignment, or the employees were given an assignment, and that assignment didn't make sense to them and didn't seem like what was needed in the situation, instead of creeping away from it or trying to do something that they didn't feel comfortable with, they reframed the assignment. Oh, we can find other ways to participate in the Bass Violin Festival. We can do it this way or that way. And that reframing of a question is very tied to one of the topics that Ian has written a lot about, which is the era of the third kind.
The era of the third kind is one, unfortunately, we commit all too often, solving the wrong problem precisely. What good does it do to solve the wrong? You go down the wrong track, you keep going down, you can't get back up. If you're working on the right problem, you get a wrong answer, you'll eventually discover it. But if you're working on the wrong problem, keep going down the track, it almost precludes learning. Let's go to the last slide here. This is the third part of the book, and don't just have time just to talk about it. One of the things when we analyze the fables in greater details, we bring these various frameworks to bear, and they really draw out deeper aspects of the fables. The first one is from Ellen Galinsky, if you know her work on life skills, the kind of things that all of us as kids need to learn so we can be well-functioning adults. I have a friend of mine who is a long life colleague and friend who's worked at, talked about conflict management. The stories, the fables are full of conflict and how you handle. People have different styles of handling conflict. We talk about the Freudian defense mechanism because in denial is a prevalent part of the fables, whether people deny there's a problem or not. We apply the Myers-Briggs and the Jungian personality styles because you can go through the fables and see that King Friday, although he's a lovable creature, he acts oftentimes very like a very rigid personality. I bring crisis management to bear, which I've worked on for years. And finally, Donna and I talk about one of the things that is virtually never talked about in programs of management, which is one of the most important areas of all, attachment theory. Those of you who know it, it was invented in World War II to help understand what children went into when they were orphaned, when they were sent away from their parents in London to escape the bombings. They almost became catatonic. And John Bowlby, who was a pediatrician psychiatrist, invented something called attachment theory, which has to do how you attach to your primary caretakers to help explain what the kids were going through and to help bring them out of it. And fortunately, unfortunately, the same attachment styles that you had as a kid, they carry forward into adulthood unless there's been some treatment and intervention. Next slide, please.
Now, we would like to be able to share all of the fables with you because they're just packed with wonderful lessons for workplaces and for adult life. So we urge you to, get in touch with us, read the stories, and we are getting prepared to conduct workshops. We'll go into organizations and help them use these stories in the way that Fred used puppets and found that children could relate to puppet characters. They would talk more to the puppet than they would talk to the live human being because there was that, that chance to speak openly without feeling threatened. So we'd love to share them with you. Don't have time, but we do want to leave some time for your questions or comments or anything.
Any questions? Dr. Silvers. This is our in-law. This our daughter's father-in-law. Yes, Dr. Silvers. I guess we can. Yeah, we can share the mic.
When you talk about management, there is a concept in the industry right now called a cluster, and it's supposed to help explain the reason why Silicon Valley is so successful, because it really the cluster really has two essence to it, and that is it has one of connectivity and communication. And I don't know if you've seen this concept, and I was wondering what your reaction to that is.
Well, first reaction, very quick, is that Fred talked about it in a different way. He had a different language. And I would say probably the best way he talked about it was the concept of a neighborhood. And the point, a big part of the book is what would it be to turn organizations into neighborhoods? That doesn't mean everything is tolerated, everything is okay. It doesn't mean that. But it says in a neighborhood you have a variety of people of economic, incomes and different personnel. And they, if they're successful, they have to learn to get along. And unfortunately, most of our organizations are more like battlefields than they're anything approaching a neighborhood. And that's the quick response.
Any other questions or comments?
Anybody else?
I love Mr. Rogers. I'm really happy that you did this book. And I was wondering what you envision as the impact on business and on administration and education and other organizations, even politically, to move to a more positive agendas or more positive ways for organizations to work that are inclusive instead of exclusive or positive.
Let me just say a quick word about our publisher, because that's one way of responding to this. Paul Greg McMillan, we're part of a new book series. And the book series is all about books that will teach business organization behavior through stories. not the traditional didactic ways. They must see a market. And so this is not necessarily a main text. I mean, the first part is not really a textbook. It's written for a general audience. But that is a window for us. Now, ideally, you know, we'd like to see this book, you know, get out. But organizations say, come on, there's a different way to, you know, other than the craziness with which we're managing ourselves.
It would apply to nonprofit organizations,
oh,
too.
Oh, any,
so that's
any
what I'm saying.
Kind
so
of
business sometimes is business, but it's also as application to a broader audience.
Of course. Nonprofits have the same issues that for-profit organizations do. And what is the impact? Well, if we can find these opportunities to get people to come together and at least talk about these seven principles that are with you no matter what kind of a group you participate in, we can get the conversation started. We think that there's a possibility that we can have an impact. It's an exciting prospect.
So one way to say it is, you know, nonprofits have great goals and missions. I don't disagree with that. They're some of the most poorly managed organizations I've ever seen. It's not enough to have a good mission. You have to have both a good mission and good management skills. And most of the organizations are lacking in one or the other. Any other questions, please?
Yes, we're conscious of your time. We know that.
I read the book as a parent, and I couldn't help but get parenting ideas. And so as you go out into organizations, one of the things you're telling us is organizations are primarily run where they're disconnecting basically your home life and your inner life with. I could picture with Donna's background and yours, part of your workshop, adding a component for them in the home. Because if you're happy at home, if you have to work longer, but they feel connected, and or repurposing this book at some point for parents. Because we don't have the show anymore.
Good point.
So I know you're just getting this book off, but I would really encourage you to add in your workshop something for the home because it demonstrates modeling that the home matters.
Well, the life skills is kind of a pathway into that, but we hear what you're saying is that when we wrote this, we really thought of very diverse audiences and that there would be different messages. So, in fact, I think one of the early drafts, it was, you know, lessons for life in general because that's, yeah. You know, that was what Fred was addressing himself to.
We've been trying to do this. It's been 10 years. And at one point, we called it Mr. Rogers for Grown-Ups. We've called it Mr. Rogers Talks to Parents. We see this as not just for the workplace, but for life in general. I'm conscious of the time, and I know that. Is there another question?
Oh, sure. We do have about 15 more minutes.
Oh, okay.
We're fine. Okay, good.
Can I just finish up a little bit on that? Actually, Mr. McFeely was to be a delivery man on the program, and you know my first name on the program was Mr. McCurdy, because Mr. McCurdy was the president at the time of the Foundation of Surgeon Robots, who gave us money to do the program. And everything was fine. The last moment, they called and said, we love your concept, but don't call the delivery man Mr. McCurdy, because it looks a little self-serving. So Fred Rogers' middle name is McFeely. And the real McFeely was his grandfather, so he said, you're now Mr. McFeely. And so I am Mr. McFeely, speedy delivery. I added that. So I'm really more of a delivery man. I take over the post office, too, but I wish I did have a solution.
Good question.
Thank you. My name is Jane. I'm Australian, as some of you probably picked up by my accent. So I didn't grow up with Mr. Rogers, and I'm really pleased that I had an excuse to find out about Mr. Rogers, courtesy of the Metro. So thank you very much. And I love the concept of the book very, very much indeed. I wanted to just pick up, sort of following on from the previous question about the integration, and particularly to ask you about the spirituality in the workplace. And one of your C's is consciousness. I mean, I think we're in the era of a great deal more aware, you know, of consciousness. And I wondered how you see that being played out in the workplace, if there are any examples that you can talk to or any thoughts that you have as sort of bringing that to the fore, and therefore the more integration of the soul and allowing us, you know, our soul to be fully present in the workplace, because then we truly can make a difference in the world if that happens.
Let me tell you the first anecdote that comes to my mind, and Don and I, we read this, and I think I've used it in another book that I'm preparing, and I'm going to forget the name of the person, and it's a Chicago-based restaurant. And the CEO, when he hires people, he goes through, you know, a standard interview and all the rest of that. And then he ends with this question to see how people respond to it. I think it's a great question. And the question is, are you a nice person? And you can just see, you know, people, they're not expecting that. Well, you know, you don't have to use, quote, spirituality, you know, directly in order to tap into it. Although when I did my interviews, I asked people directly, and these are people who work for a for-profit organization, who are hard-nosed and all the rest of that, because the words carry a lot of baggage, you know, should we avoid them? And the vast majority said, no, you got to tell it like it is. You can't beat around the bush. And you're not doing spirituality, you know, just for profits. You got to do it for its own sake to be a good organization. Because if you look at what people want to work for, yes, they want to make money, obviously, in hard economic time. They want to work for a good ethical organization. Now, whether the organization will allow them to do that or not, you know, they want their work to have meaning. In fact, that's one of the main themes in the book. People are meaning-seeking, creating creatures. And oftentimes we just beat that out of it. See, that's why the Bass Violin Festival is one of our favorite fables or parables. That we scare the creativity out of people. Because when you're creative, you ask what seems to be ridiculous questions. And that, you know, going back to Silicon Valley, you know, failure, that's, you can live with that.
I think people are. Some people have to leave. I've noticed a few leaving. And David does have a special message, so we can continue to talk, but before you have to leave.
Before you have to leave, on the little statement I gave you, the wisdom, if there is a red dot, we have a book for each person who has a red dot to be autographed, and I hope they haven't left, but the red dotters haven't left. Maybe
they
have.
Anybody here with a red dot?
I think maybe they have
maybe
left.
Maybe they left. They were going to get a free autographed copy. Wait till they open it up and find they have a red dot.
Shall we flip a coin? But I also do have a picture. If anybody wants an autograph for anybody, I'll be glad to do it. I have plenty of time, so don't worry about me. So if you have other questions, or I don't know how we...
Well, we'll have to be creative, won't we? Come up with a different way of doing it.
One of the things that I keep thinking about is, you know, as you're talking, and of course the amazing Fred Rogers, is you have to really have a tremendous amount of awareness, right? Being, let's say, a CEO or somebody who is a leader in any organization. So what is your take on that? You know, it's sort of like, how do you... That seems to me the biggest challenge is, how do you get people to be more aware of themselves and aware of others?
Well, I mean, of course, that's the $64 trillion question. The way I would best respond to it shortly is that there is no question, but in today's environment, the requisites to become a CEO or leader have increased enormously. Look, the normal pathway for most people to become CEO of a major organization has been accounting, finance, or operations. I mean, look, I grew up in engineering. I can do that. I I left engineering because I was more interested in people and organizations. So the point is, and that's where being a professor of business, we have really failed. Because, you know, most people who go to business school, not all, but a lot go there for, quote, the hard skills. 10 to 15 years out, they wake up and say, oh, my God, I wasn't paying attention in all the organizational behavior classes, you know, the politics and different personalities. MBA, undergraduate business education, is in need of serious revamping. Probably the best way, I would say, is that Don and I would address it through life skills, how we teach critical thinking, perspective taking, and all. And if we would formulate, which we haven't, MBA and undergraduate business programs around, say, the work of Ellen Galinsky. That wouldn't solve everything, but it would make a dent.
We will be speaking at the Academy of Management in the summer, and we will be speaking to professors of business and practitioners of business, and encouraging them to at least get on this trolley, and and try to give attention to the human aspect of their organizations. We always say to ourselves the time has finally come, but we think it has, because something has to change, and we like to be part of the change and not part of the problem. Question over there?
I have my name is Cindy, and I have, I think, more of a comment and an observation than a question, but you might be able to speak to it as well. My working career has been over 30 years, and it's all been in project management, which is one of the reasons why I'm here today. And I've noticed a change over the years. And I actually took a little hiatus from work from 2005 till just recently in the last couple of years, because when I left in 2005, things were so stressful, and I had just was really like at a burnout place. I just rejoined, I'm back doing what I was doing before, and I've noticed a change. Just that absence really brought it to light. And that before, things were so stressful, and working in a team effort, there was a lot of just finger pointing and blame, as 10 and 15 years ago. And it was all about whose court was the ball in. It's like, get it out of my court, boom. And that was kind of the mental attitude. And in rejoining in the same profession, I'm finding the last couple of years is more about, it's just about a team effort. People on the team are trying to help each other do their work better. And it's amazing. It really is amazing. And that has changed just recently in the last 10 years.
It's a fable for that. Yeah, that's right. But a comment, I think one of the most helpful signs is this. We have friends who, one in particular, has written a book on the millennial generation. And the millennial generation, not perfect, wanting to be CEO in 2 weeks, that kind of stuff. They are different. They've grown up working boys and girls together. They're less sexist, racist, homophobic, not perfect, whether they come from conservative families or liberal families, there's a real shift now, where hopefully that will sift its way through. It's already made a difference in politics, for crying out loud, in the 2008-2012 elections, if you look at the demographics that what President Obama won. And that is seeping its way into organizations. In fact, that's really why Planet Purple is also one of our favorite fables. And in our response to it, we concocted an alternate fable, Planet Prism, where you go to a planet where, it's heterogeneous, they're different people. Well, maybe I had to say one thing that, whether you had a question, you might be curious. What was it like for two very strong people, both with two firstborns, both with their own careers, successful, to come together and collaborate on such a project? It wasn't easy. There was a number of times where we felt like just chucking it, but we hung in because both of our ongoing work going on, or how many years going on?
Going on 50.
Going on 50 years of being married. But because we love Fred Rogers, we love the project, and we, in, even though, you know, we get turned down by publishers, we kept on going because this project was unlike anything that I've ever, you know, I mean, I write serious books. I write them hopefully that the lay people can read them.
I have one more C to add to that, which is collaboration. That's what you did.
That's what we did.
And the C of collaboration really is what it what works.
Hard at times.
Before we do a question, I made blank pieces of paper, and two of them have a dot. So,
oh, good idea.
There you go.
Yeah,
well, we have some books for sale.
We have some books, but we want to, we do want to give two of them away. Can we advance to the next slide?
Oh, should I ask my last?
Pass them out while you're advancing.
I want to advance to the next slide and introduce you to Rena. Rena Nyman is our publicist, and Rena has. We watch me mess this up. There. Rena has put up a website, and if you'd like to be part of the conversation, she does Twitters, she does, you know, Rena, all things.
Well, we have a website there, and we've got a Facebook page, and we have a Twitter feed, and I've been putting quotes up. And
so if you go to www.mrrogersfables.com, be part of the conversation. So www.mrrogersfables.com. Fables.com.
And in case it hasn't been made obvious to you yet, this is our daughter. And she, Dana Mitchell Silvers, produced the PowerPoint and pulled together all of the slides. We found the picture of her mom and dad when they were, you know, still had hair and skinny arms. we put it all together. And we're proud to have her here with us today. And lastly, we have given you our email addresses here on the screen. So if you're interested in contacting us, we know that the book is very expensive. And if you're interested in purchasing a copy at the author's price, contact us on email. And we can, it's listed at Paul Gray Macmillan for $95. That's in textbook price. And it's listed on Amazon for between $75 and $95, and we can sell it 40% off, and we're happy to do that. So contact us there.
And two winners got, we got two winners.
We have two.
Oh, there's one.
Oh my gosh!
Here, Donna, sign your name.
And
we have two.
Who's the other?
With Ray
Dawson,
right there.
Well, two winners. Okay.
Yeah,
come on up. Come on up.
And King Friday will say thank you very much for coming. This is not the real King Friday. It's a puppet of a puppet. But I thought I'd bring him to close out this session. That's King Friday the 13th. Thank you very much for coming. And speak you livery. And I have these I can sign off.
Can I get pictures with you?
Sure.
We're not quite done yet, so we do have an official format here at the Commonwealth Club that we need to follow. Okay. So we have time actually for one more question because we would like to make this at least an hour program for the podcast and radio. I would like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host this afternoon. Our program today is Applying the Wisdom of Mr. Rogers to the Workplace with Ian Mitroff, Donna Mitroff, and actor David Newell, who is well known as Mr. McFeely. So I'd like to thank you all for coming, and we will now turn it over for one more question, and then we'll close our program today.
One of the things that people notice is the concept of fear of failure. And we see this in the school system. Instead of learning from your failure, you can become very embarrassed. Hierarchical organizations, in a sense, promote that. In a sense, you're afraid to contradict the hierarchy on top. I was wondering, do you have fables and Mr. Rogers.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, the Planet Purple is about the hierarchical organizations, mm-hmm. and the bass violin
is about challenging.
All about challenging that and the fear of fable. And I'm glad that I forget your name. That this earlier questioner raised the point, making the comment that organizations, in spite of themselves, are changing. Because the problems that organizations are confronting today are far more complex and only becoming more complex, that no one single person or function can really address them. And that's partly why we need good teams, integrative teams. Anyway, that's the short response. Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. We do have a few books for those.
Okay, good. And let me close the program down officially. We do have a format here that I'd like to just close down with, and I'd like to thank everyone here at the Commonwealth Club of California for coming today. Everyone listening at home, our program tonight has been Applying the Wisdom of Mr. Rogers to the Workplace. Our panelists have been David Newell, the actor known as Mr. McFeely, Ian Mitroff, and Donna Mitroff. And with that, I'd like to thank you all and close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of public enlightenment.